There's no escape.
Good evening.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, so that is, unless I'm otherwise mistaken, that is the first sort of jungle drum and bass, call it what you want, track that I think we've ever played on the show, isn't it?
I'm pretty certain it is. We might have got a little bit of jungle in there. We've definitely got some hardcore in the past. You brought in We Are IE.
Yeah, a bit Lenny DeIce. But we've never gone this far forward. It's quite weird. And I say this far forward, this is like...
this far forward into the 90s.
Yeah, 1999.
Yeah, it sounds like it is.
Yeah, but this was sort of the last time drum and bass was interesting to me for some reason. Right. I'm totally happy, by the way, for other people to prove me wrong on that. I'd love it. So if you're listening, evening, by the way, if you're listening, by all means, get in touch and you know, suggest better tracks than this. This is Ram Trilogy, by the way, with the chase scene from the Molten Beats album, which dug out the other day and thought, got to be played. So, welcome.
Here we are again, Mr. Trick and Wrong Tom. He's Mr. Trick, I'm Wrong Tom.
Indeed.
Let's get the communication stuff out the way. You can tell us whether you know any better drum and bass tracks than that, or just tell us to fuck off by going on Twitter and hitting us up at Trick and Tom. That's it, isn't it? Yeah, no.com. Sorry, I'm a bit out of it. I was ill last week, hence why we didn't have another show, and I'm still quite slightly reeling from it. so you'll have to bear with me, as ever.
Yes. So come on, tweet us at Trick and Tom. Let us know. I put it to you, dear listeners. After this, kind of, you know, this is about the last time I was really kind of buzzed by any kind of drum and bass junglist stuff. Is this drum and bass or junglist stuff?
This is drum and bass.
Is it? Is it? Right.
Definitely.
Okay. So, but the thing I always like about this record is when I put it on, if I'm going anywhere, I get there quicker. If I'm on foot. It's definitely...
We've talked about this quite a bit, music for travelling, and there are certain tunes that, for obvious reasons, make you go faster, you particularly. And I think there's probably, there might be a few different authorities keeping an eye on you after a while if you keep telling us about this.
I know, I love this. It's that you put it on, and when this song starts, you sit there and you're sort of like, oh, it's getting pacey, and then when the beat kicks in, you're just like, whoa, come on! And you start going really, really quick. I love it. You get anywhere much, much faster. Whereas, if I listen to any Lee Perry, I generally don't really get where I'm going at all. You just tend to sit down and think, I'll just relax. It's no rush. Therein lies the difference. Anyway.
Okay.
So, But yeah, that is the first time. I'm kind of, I feel like we should play more now. We're going to be back next week. Perhaps we should do a drum and bass special.
Yeah.
Sometime.
I reckon we could.
Why not?
Yeah, I'm sure we've got enough to go around.
Yeah. But that's the thing. I was looking through all mine and I've got so many kind of classic old tunes and was sat there just thinking, bloody hell. I'm sure somewhere there's like a real aficionado. It's like, it's going to be sitting there going, oh, I can't believe you've got, I don't know, Pesce piano tune, all that hoo-ha.
I generally find with that kind of thing, if you're not a specialist in it, especially for some reason with drum and bass, people are just kind of like, well, why did you play that and not that? And it's a really nerdy genre, bizarrely, considering its roots.
Not with the nerdy genres when people get all sniffy about stuff and gets my nerves.
Yeah.
Not like we ever do that, is it, Tom?
Well, I'd argue we don't really. We're just nerds in general.
Fair point.
Yep.
So right then, that's my opening gambit. I can imagine pace tempo wise, whatever you term it, it's probably downhill from here. I know it is in my case actually, because I know how I'm playing tonight. Anyway, what you got for us?
Well, I'm going to flip the script, as they say. I'm on another radio show after this tonight. I'm on NTS Live.
NTS Live.
Yeah, NTS Live. They're based over in Dalston, and it's Tim Noakes from Dazed and Confused does a show called Synth Heroes.
Okay.
And so he's asked me to come down and select my favourite synth tracks. I thought, well, I've been going through synth records all morning, trying to like pick out different synth pop and synth reggae related things. So I'm going to go to the other extreme and play all acoustic music on our show tonight.
Fair enough.
Which I think is really nice, because it's definitely offset the aggro drum and bass of Ram Records for the intro there.
Yeah.
This one's still a little bit angsty and a little bit aggro. This is probably the only piece of, or at least the only decent piece of acoustic punk that exists. This is the Violent Femmes.
Someone, a person to talk to, someone who cared to love. Could it be you? Could it be you? Situation gets rough, then I start to panic. It's not enough. It's just the habit, a kid, you're sick. Well, darling, this is it. You can all just kiss off into the air. Behind my back, I can see them stare. They'll hurt me bad, but I won't mind. They'll hurt me bad, they do it all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they do it all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
They do it all the time.
Do it all the time.
They do it all the time.
Do it all the time.
They do it all the time.
Do it all the time.
Do it all the time. I hope you know that this will go down on your permanent record. Oh yeah? Well, don't get so distressed. Did I happen to mention that I'm impressed? Cause you left me, and two, two, two for my family, and three, three, three for my heartache, and four, four, four for my headaches, and five, five, five for my lonely, and six, six, six for my sorrow, and seven, seven for no tomorrow, and eight, eight, I forget what eight was for, but nine, nine, nine for lost God, ten, 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 ten. Oh, you can all just kiss off into the air. Behind my back, I can see them stare. They'll hurt me bad, but I won't mind. They'll hurt me bad, they do it all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they do it all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they do it all the time.
Like it. That's really good. And I was kind of blissfully unaware of It's weird with the Violent Femmes. I've kind of know of them, as I'm sure many do, and then I couldn't hum you any of their songs.
I reckon you could hum this one. I mean, actually, I'm just going to put on the start of the first track, because I will guarantee you'll know it. You'll know this straight away as soon as you hear the opening line. Well, the opening riff.
Go on it.
Where is it? Somewhere.
Oh yeah. Yep. Know that one.
There you go.
There we are. Yes. Okay.
Yep. Blister in the Sun. That's the opening track from their eponymously titled album. I like a lot of their later stuff, but after the first album they sort of left the acoustic thing aside, which is a shame because I think that was their real strength.
Yeah.
Even though it's not all strictly acoustic, that track was. It was all acoustic, but not double bass, but acoustic bass and acoustic guitar. The drums, I think, were actually just it's like a Scotch marching drum with brushes.
Right, right.
Which I think happens in quite a lot of the tracks. They obviously used cocktail kits and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But their real strong point was busking, hence the acoustic thing.
What, as in they used to busk properly?
Yeah, well, they just continued. I think they actually preferred being out on the street busking than they did doing gigs in the end, because they really honed their sound. There's found some, it's on YouTube, there's a short film made about them, bizarrely for an Australian TV channel, where it's got them on tour in New York, and it has them busking out on the streets, and it just sounds exactly like they do on record. It's incredible.
Wow.
Which is worth seeking out.
Yeah. I never knew.
Yeah, but it's great. I mean, can you name any other acoustic punk bands?
Not off the top of my head.
I'm sure there are some out there, but I'm also certain that I've definitely heard a few tracks by people, and they're either pale imitations of what the Violent Femmes were up to in their early days, or they're just crap.
That's probably a fairly fair assertion. No, I was going to say potentially the Monks of Doom may come close, but not quite.
It's a good name, but I don't know them.
They were a side project of Camper Van Beethoven.
So, excellent.
But they were very kind of acoustic, but not so much punky. I'm sure someone out there would violently disagree with me. All puns intended.
Quite
so, but that was great.
Yeah. The thing that I really love about it is there's something, I mean, it's just so teen angsty.
Yeah.
Like all of their songs are just, you know, they're just embroiled with this, like, kind of just desperation, high school desperation. But I think he does it with such joy. It's like he's really, really enjoying being that desperate. And I thought it's an interesting notion, isn't it?
Yeah. Weren't we all?
Yeah, maybe. I thought that it was like an in joke. But the more I've read about them, and the more interviews I've read and seen, I've got the impression that he is a genuinely fucked up individual.
Yeah.
I know the rest of the band all hate the singer now, or I think they did. They got back together for a bit. And then I saw some real kind of real bile written by one of the other members talking about how he'd he couldn't write songs anymore, and he has to make his money by selling their songs off to crap car adverts and that kind of thing. Which a lot of artists these days go, well, where's the problem there? But I guess, you know, they really for a long time stuck to their guns.
In my experience, those people tend to say that while taking the paycheck from said sale and all that. So.
Maybe the one writing didn't have a writing credit on it. Maybe that's it.
But yeah.
Who
knows.
But I mean, I tend to think that their later output wasn't half as good as the first album. So, that's Violent Femmes from 1983. Bit of acoustic punk. The track's called Kiss Off.
Lovely. I'm going to play some Jack Nietzsche.
Oh, yeah.
So, I kind of sort of stumbled on this, really, in the sense that I didn't know that Jack Nietzsche actually put out any records. So obviously, to those who don't know Jack Nietzsche, you probably do know him in the sense that he was one of Phil Spector's Wrecking Crew. But he was also the guy that did all the strings on Neil Young's Harvest album. And he's worked with various other people, none of whom I can name right now. But he sort of was part of the Wrecking Crew, and then he pretty much bedded himself in that whole, valley scene in California and everything, and kind of got very sucked into all of that. And yeah, it was kind of news to me that he'd done any albums at all, because he's usually this sort of figure in the background doing the orchestral arrangements and everything else. And it turned out that, Rhino, the reissues label? Universal's reissues label.
I think Rhino were putting stuff out. They're not strictly reissues, are they?
They are now. They're more of a sort of catalogue label, yeah. But they did this kind of very limited box set of three albums, one of which never came out, one of which was done with an orchestra kind of inspired by the stuff he'd done on the Harvest record. But then it's really interesting because on this kind of triple box set thing that they put out, on at the end of it, there's four demos, and basically the demos are the best thing on the whole lot because they're just really stripped down and straightforward. And it's kind of weird because I was reading about this and it's quite bizarre in the sense that the song I'm about to play, I think the lyrics were written by Robert Downey, as in Robert Downey Jr.'s dad, if I'm not mistaken. And it's about that woman in LA that was the seamstress for all the bands that was the focus of the song Tiny Dancer by Elton John. So it's kind of, all of it is a bit, whoops, sorry.
What was that?
I think that was more drum and bass. But it was, yeah, so it's just kind of this whole mess of sort of name drops and madness. But it kind of, yeah, it's turned out into quite a bizarre little side thing. And yeah, check it out anyway. So yeah, it's Jack Nietzsche and I'll Bet She Knew It. And this is the demo version, though, as far as I know, there was never a full version. So set up what you can. Make of that then.
It's nice.
It's not stellar in the sense of you don't sit and go, wow, that's amazing, because basically he's channeling pretty much all the people he worked with. So
it was very, very Bowie.
Do you think?
Yeah.
But given it was about 1970?
Yeah, I just still felt the essence of Bowie there.
The stench.
Yeah, the stench of Bowie.
The thin white Duke was all over it.
You know, I'm not a massive fan, but at the same time, there's certain Bowie tracks that I absolutely love. That wasn't one of them. No,
no. Look, you know, it's fair criticism.
It's good. I think my issue with it was it was a little bit too slick. It's like it was all there and very much so, kind of telling you it's all there. Like, you know, it was all very polished.
Do you think it's the Vanity album problem?
Yeah, I'm sure
it's
it
is. It's the kind of, I'm going to make a record, and then I've got a big studio, and I'm going to spend lots of money, and big orchestra, and all that. And it just sort of was like, hang on, you forgot something there, mate, like the spirit and the soul.
Yeah.
But no, I quite like it. But then I must admit, I'm a little bit of a sucker for anything that's kind of got that slight whiff of the sort of California Valley scene thing of the late 60s, early 70s. Any of that thing that makes me think of Sunshine, kind of, you know, just all the good things in life. It's a bit of a hangover from the Beach Boys, maybe. Yeah, I don't know.
I like
sort of thing.
I like the darkness, not the band.
I believe you're gonna think called.
Yeah, I should add. I don't love the band at all. Yeah, I like to sit and wallow with a Violent Femmes number in the dark.
See, I go the other way. I don't do darkness. I just go outright, kind of, you know, apoplectic rage. Hence the Slayer addiction. Mm. You know, I'll go Sunny Valley, kind of loving, like, hey, this is great. And then I go to Slayer and Meshuggah, and there's not really much of a point in between. Although I have got quite a dark track to play after your one.
I'd say Ram Records probably fits somewhere in between, doesn't it?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay, that's me told. Right, what you got?
I have some shamanic jazz.
Nice. Shamanic jazz. Funny, yeah. I was thinking earlier of bringing in some Heathen Doom that a friend had turned me onto. An amazing band who have Acorn Leaves for Faces. But I'm going to keep it for another show. So, shamanic jazz.
Yep, shamanic jazz. Right. I can't tell you anything more about it aside that. This is this is from the album Symbols of Hopi or Hopi. I don't know.
Hopi?
Yeah, I'm guessing it's Hopi, but you never know.
Yeah.
Let's have a little chat after we listen to some, because I'm wondering how long you can put up with the drumming.
Oh God! Let's if this is free out. Jazz, Tom, you no, know what? No, no, no. You know what comes with the free jazz?
It's quite the opposite.
All right, slap it on. Could have been worse. Could have been free jazz.
I think it's a nice little number myself. I know you weren't quite taken with the Hopi drumming or the
to be fair, I did say it was like the scene in Karate Kid the musical in Phoenix Nights where they're doing the, you know, wipe on that whole thing. It's a bit like that. It is the sound.
It's a bit like that, but with a little bit more effort put in. And
I'd imagine it's the sound of what would happen if you gave me a drum and just said, tap along. And I'd sat there.
Oh, dear. You're breaking the gear now, but that's what happens.
Tap to mic, wreck the studio.
I like the fact we've faded it down to talk over the bit where the old cottonwood drumming stops.
Yeah.
So that was the inimitable work of Lewis Moffsey on the cottonwood drum there.
Yeah, I mean...
And rattles. He was actually, when you said he's playing with one hand, he was, because he's playing the cottonwood drum with one hand and he's doing the rattles with the other.
Fair enough.
You know, which was part of the... it's not essentially shaman, because he's actually Native American, but, I mean, these things kind of transfer into different beliefs. They're very similar ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like, one of the things I learned with shaman drumming, not that I've ever personally done it myself, but I've looked into it, being a percussionist myself, you'd have someone that would sort of beat the drum relentlessly until they went into a trance, into a bit of a stupor.
Yep.
And then they have to have a kind of an assistant shaman with them to continue beating the drum when they can no longer do so.
It's a bit like taking flight, isn't it?
Yeah.
You got to keep going. And once you're up in the air, some other bugger's then got to keep flapping while you engage brain.
Yeah. Well, not
makes sense.
When you engage with the spirits and talk to whoever you're trying to track down.
Yeah, it's the same thing as all the you know, Moroccan, you know, master musicians and all that stuff with the hashishim and things.
Yeah, totally. I saw I saw some what do you call them? The guys that spin round.
Whirling dervishes.
I saw some of them at Glastonbury one year, and it was brilliant. One of them, I wasn't sure if it was for comedy benefit of the audience or what, but as they all went into their trance, one of them, his eye opened and looked around. And then as they all started whirling, he just fell over. It was incredible. He kept getting up and trying again.
Amazing.
And we were just sitting there in stitches, you know. And bear in mind, this is basically the first act on in my friend's tent in the Greenfields. There's a lot of people that have been up for like 3 days solid on the Sunday, you know, maybe 4 or 5 days, some of them. And they were out of it. And we're just sitting there creasing up at this poor guy. And after a bit, I was like, this isn't a joke. He's actually seriously trying to whirl without being in the trance. Poor fella.
That's
not something you want to attempt.
No.
We did notice as we went out the back, they all took off their garments and put on the nice suits and got into estate cars. Which was great.
Oh, God, it's like estate agents letting loose for the weekend.
Yeah.
Awful.
So, anyway, this project is run by someone called Jill McManus, who, if I have a look on the back, there's Jill on the piano,
mm-hmm.
the trumpet and flugelhorn player who you disliked. It's Tom Harrell. And the reason why I actually bought this is because I'm mistaken. In a bit of a rush, I was in The Thing in Brooklyn.
Right.
You know, the big basement record shop. It's a thrift store
right.
in Greenpoint in Brooklyn. I was first introduced to it by my friend John, who's a sometimes listener of the show. So, John, if you're listening, hello. He took me down there. And there's about 80,000 records in the basement of this place, all for a couple of bucks each.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sort of Q-tips being known to dig there, and you see quite a few people down there.
Yeah.
I've bought some amazing stuff. If I'm in New York, I generally put like half a day aside to go and have a look through.
Mm-hmm.
And I think last time I was there, last summer, I was there with our friend Ed Zed.
Mm-hmm.
We went digging for some stuff, and I picked this up really quickly. And I read Billy Hart on drums, and in my head I went Mickey Hart from The Grateful Dead.
Right.
I'm a big fan of, believe it or not. He wrote this incredible book called Planet Drum, where he just charts the history of drumming and goes into explicit detail, which is why I kind of learned a bit about sort of shamanic drumming and, you know, the different cultures that do similar things.
Mm.
It's definitely well worth checking out, but completely unrelated, I'm afraid, because it's actually Billy Hart, who I'm not sure who he's played for. Quite a few people, I believe.
Really?
Yeah.
Name doesn't ring a bell for me, but that's not saying a lot in my case.
If you looked it up, I'm sure you'd be quite surprised. I think he's done some real big names, and not just in jazz.
Yeah.
But yeah, so anyway.
Good though. It's listenable. Wasn't free jazz, so we'll take that as a plus right there.
Yeah. The track's called Corn Dance.
Lovely. Right, so do I go with the dark sort of electronic end of things now, or just the more kind of amped up, kind of emotionally kind of charged something else?
Fuck emotion. Let's go for dark electronic.
Dark electronic. Okay, so I was kind of getting on a bit of a thing the other day. I'm sort of going through this phase at the moment of getting quite obsessed with the near history, because there's always this
near
thing.
Near history, what, last week?
Nearly. Kind of more like the turn of the century, but, you know.
Yeah.
Not. So, I mean, it's the same reason. There's a good reason as playing the RAM records, because I've just sort of wanted to revisit that bit that people ignore, because it's not quite far enough in the past yet.
Not Electro Clash.
No.
Big Beat?
Never liked Electroclash. No, Big Beat was sort of 96, wasn't it? I'm past 96.
It carried on. It kind of turned into New School Breaks, didn't it?
I don't know. I kind of was just going through all that stuff. Like, I think I mentioned it before, the kind of Mill Plateau and all those sorts of things. And, it just kind of wanted to go and dig through all those really weird dark beats that you used to get around that period that kind of went with it was like Mill Plateau, Word Sound, and it wasn't really the Ilbient thing. In fact, it was pretty much restricted to a very small few labels. Kind of digital hardcore touched on it at one point as well, and all that sort of stuff.
You're saying this stuff as if I'd know. Kind of looking at me like I'm going to go, yeah, I haven't got a clue what you're talking about.
It's just like, it's that kind of end of filthy sort of dub led slow-mo break beats.
Right.
Certainly Word Sound led with it in the States, and I'd argue probably Mill Plateau kind of led with it over here. And you had bands like Techno Animal that was sort of Kev Martin, I think, was in Techno Animal, mainly Justin Broderick from Godflesh trying to do dancier things and everything else.
Kev from The Bug.
Yes, Kev Martin, okay. And so I just kind of, I've been sort of digging through all that stuff because I don't see much of that around anymore. And I like that thing that was sort of, it's kind of funky, but it's definitely not danceable and definitely not happy. It's kind of quite dark, dirty, kind of grotty sounding, but it keeps the funk, and the funk element is the bit that drives it, because when it doesn't have that, I mean, I could tour you through a number of, you know, Techno Animal things, and basically when they're not doing the funky thing where it's got the break and got the groove to it, it just flat out doesn't work. It sounds like a bad industrial record, at which point it's like, if you're going to do industrial, do it properly and go absolutely balls out for that. But if you're going to do it with this kind of dance touch to it,
put your balls away.
Keep the groove in there. And yeah, I kind of led me on through trailing through various other things to this album I'd sort of forgotten about that I had, which was Porter Rix versus Techno Animal. And Porter Rix were kind of, I believe, German sort of minimal techno, and then Techno Animal were kind of more your sort of grotty, dirty end of things. And I'm not selling it in well, am I?
So come on, let's just hear a bit of this dirty, grotty, sexless funk that you've been touting.
Fair enough. So,
one thing that I think is quite interesting about that is I've been listening to quite a lot of old B-boy stuff the last couple of weeks.
What's in B-boy records?
Yeah, the label.
Yeah.
Particularly kind of like the dubbier and the instrumental sides, for some reason, just had a hankering for it. One of the things that turned me onto it was I dug out the dub mix of Elementary by BDP.
Yeah.
Which never got released originally. It got put out on a triple pack CD of Criminal Minded.
Mm-hmm.
And it's they basically just mastered the original dub plate. I don't know whose copy it was, like KRS-One's dub plate or something, that you know, never saw the light of day. But because it's off a dub plate, and obviously it's been played for years and it's worn out, it's really crackly and really dirty and, you know, murky. And it's funny that reminds me of that. Kind of like almost, I don't know if it's intended, that like that's the kind of feeling that I got when I go back and listen to my old tape of the tape that I made of my original copy of JVC Force and stuff like that. I kind of just like, you get all the tape hiss and the murk, and it's like that is recreating in the studio what those records became from having them on tape for so long.
Yeah, I think it's probably a fair assertion. I mean, I don't know. There's not much of that stuff around. I wouldn't say it ever became like a scene. You know what I mean? It wasn't like bunches of people making that. It was pretty much about five artists. Yeah. You could probably narrow it down to.
And it's very much the sound of people staying in as well, you know, which is always going to be the instant killer for a scene, isn't it? Because you're not going anywhere, then.
No, this was never a scene for. It just wasn't a music type for a scene full stop, really, because it couldn't be.
Yeah.
On the grounds that it was sort of eminently antisocial by design. You know what I mean? It wasn't something you put on and we're like, yeah, all right, and which, sit around nodding their heads.
Yeah, so, it warms me to it somehow.
I always liked it as just like a weird angle on the sort of hip hop speed breaks, you know, the breaks around kind of 95 to 105 beats a minute. But just with that kind of real focus on the grottiness, because labels like Digital Hardcore went the other way and sped it all up, and it was just like dirty drum and bass almost, you know, and shoutiness and punk guitars. And that was all right, but it was a bit novelty, whereas this to me was a bit deeper, and in a strange way was just like a logical strand from exactly what you say, that kind of just the lo-fi beats that you inevitably got from kind of SP-1200s and things like that, you know, back in the day, and you know, but that whole sound. And it's weird because as fidelity got higher, everyone wanted cleaner beats, and they kind of immediately gravitated to 808s and the low boom and all of that stuff. And I kind of preferred, well, not preferred, but I have a place in my heart for that stuff as well. That's just really dirty, and I love it's. It definitely takes a sort of, you know, a thing from the basic channel kind of Maurizio, you know, that very rhythm and sound kind of spatial minimal techno that happened, and sort of turned into minimal techno dub, or however you term it. But I like that. I like the spatial thing of just masses of reverb around tracks with something holding it down in the middle, namely in this case the breakbeat. But yeah, I don't know. I sort of stumbled on that the other day and was just thinking, bloody hell, this is really good. And it's a really forgotten record as well.
Yeah. I liked it. It was kind of ambient without being ambient, you know, in quotes.
Yeah. No, it's good stuff. So, you know, as I was saying to you when it was playing, I'm sort of curious about that thing of, I think we all try and, a scene happens and then everyone tends to let it go and then we forget about it. And while the recycle period is getting smaller, it is still sort of generally regarded that about 20 years is the point at which people, you know, reinstate something, declare it as being, you know, fashionable again or whatever. And in this case, I was just kind of curious about the things that perhaps at the moment are really not very fashionable, and digging them out and playing them again and sort of reappraising them. So that, hence, you know, Ram Records 99, Porter Ricks, I forget what year that was, but it was about 2003 maybe, you know, all those sorts of things, and just kind of seeing if they hold up. Some do, some really don't, but yeah, it's just interesting to revisit and see.
Yeah.
Anyway, there we go. What you got?
Worth going down that route. I was just going to say, we got any fun stuff to read out? Is anyone being in contact?
We've got Grace Baseface in, locked in for some shamanic jazz, but beyond that, no, it's been a quiet one.
Oh dear.
These long winter nights, people are away watching I'm a Celebrity. Anyway, no matter, we carry on unabated.
Yes.
What you got?
Well, I'm not going to go too far from the old kind of murky hip-hop fray, because I've got some Mike Ladd.
Right. Is this Infesticons?
This is his most recent Infesticons.
Was there more than one Infesticons then?
Yeah, he did. There was the first one, which was
I guess about 2000.
So what's like the rub that. Though? Because wasn't there like the Majesticons, Infesticons, and
yeah? Well, the whole deal was when he did the Infesticons, he came up. You open up the cover, and there's all the information and all the different people in his universe. You know, these Infesticons who are the Freedom Fighters fighting against the Majesticons, who were kind of the blinged out, money grabbing, money orientated folk.
Okay.
And then at the top of that, you had the Trusticons who hide their wealth.
Right.
And you know, they're like the Illuminati in charge of everything. But then he had the Domesticons, who were, you know, the kind of neutral people that just lived in suburban houses and got on with their lives and didn't really have an opinion, you know. Right. And you can kind of see the social commentary going on there. He did the first album, Infesticons, about a decade back now. I think it was about 2000, 2001. Followed it in 2003, if I'm not wrong, with the Majesticons LP,
mm-hmm.
and then nothing for years. And then it was while I was working on Duppy Writer, I heard that he was like all set to release the third instalment. And I think originally, something's going on in the background there.
Just the CD having a shit fit, don't worry about it.
I quite like it.
Yeah, it's gone all glitched out.
Yeah. What was I saying? Yeah, so he's all set to release his third album. And yeah, and apparently he came along with a load of kind of acoustic-y songs, or like a handful of them, and he wanted to do a Domesticons album, kind right. of these acoustic ballads about washing machines and kitchenware and stuff like that.
Okay.
I hope this is true. It might have just been someone kind of exaggerating slightly, but I like the idea of it. But I think in the end they were kind of like, look, we need to do something that we can also sell. So he did a follow-up to the Infesticons album, where the Infesticons have been in hiding since this war that's gone on between them and the Majesticons. And they've come out and the war's ended and they don't know what's going on in the world, and they're kind of slightly out of touch, which I guess summed up a lot of that generation of kind of like late 90s rappers that had fallen off and
yep.
missed the whole kind of Baltimore thing and spank rock and all that. Which is kind of referenced on the album as well. But one acoustic-y number actually slipped through the net and wound up on the album, and it's the final track on the album. It's called Sky's Anthem. And it's not Mike Ladd's greatest track, but as I said, I'm doing an all-acoustic show, and I think it's a nice little number. So should we give it a blast?
Absolutely.
Tender in these dead seas.
I love that.
It's a haunting little number, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great little song. Yeah, I thought it was really, really good.
Very sparse, very simple, but great. And I'm always worried about it when you hear about rappers doing acoustic stuff.
I couldn't even name many instances where someone say that, if I'm honest.
Everlast.
Ooh.
And just generally bands that aren't really known for it, trying to pull it off. I remember, obviously they're not a great example anyway, but I'm still, you know, harbour a slight soft spot for Galliano, but when they did their third album, they ended with an acoustic number that, you know, really was pretty much More Than Words by Extreme. Oof. Proper old stinker.
That song just makes me want to kill people.
The thing about More Than Words is it's shocking, but it could never be worse than Get the Funk Out.
I know it could.
No, it really could. Oh, for me, it could.
It's insipid.
Of course, it's insipid, but at least they're not wearing bowler hats and, you know, trying to. You know, like, I didn't think personally you could do funk worse than the Red Hot Chili Peppers in their, you know, like heyday, but Extreme proved it was very much possible.
Yeah, I could actually name quite a few bands that proved it was eminently more possible to plumb depths much, much lower than the Chili Peppers.
Fortunately, I either missed it or just shied away from that side of things. I couldn't handle it.
It feels, though, that discussing this is just like picking through feces. I mean, it just is, you know, there's absolutely no merit to it whatsoever.
Yeah. End of the day, we just played a great piece of music, so we shouldn't really be talking about Extreme at all, should we?
No, I thought it was really good. And it is brave, because I would imagine. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, like any kind of pivot, I suppose, to put it in terms of, you know, your sound, when people are expecting a kind of hip-hop record and you deliver that,
yeah,
that's brave, you know, but I think that takes balls.
Even the rest of the album, I mean, the opening track's kind of like a black rock tune.
Right.
You know, if you know what I mean, that kind of like, you know, sort of mix of early Hendrix, early Funkadelic, even like early KC and the Sunshine Band, kind of that sort of driving, slightly psyched out blues funk rock.
And good on him.
With a touch of rap going on in there, obviously, because it's Mike Ladd, but I think that's one of the great things about him. He can pull it off. He did that on a slightly Prince-esque album once,
right?
For K7. He's done this is like a 10-inch of kind of punk material.
Really?
Yeah,
that,
yeah.
That
quite,
I didn't know.
Quite sort of hardcore material, which I'm sure it's Mike Ladd. There's a lot of records out there. I might be mistaken, but I'm pretty sure he did.
Things are, you know, it's I don't know, like I've always got that, I think it's that English thing of rooting for an underdog, but I kind of like that thing where you get an artist that's made a really, you know, has just decided to completely do their own thing, and it kind of, see with that, it's like the performance on it and everything else isn't stellar, it's rough and ready, but that's precisely what makes it so endearing to listen to.
Yeah, completely.
And I love that. And sometimes you do get a polished product and it works. And other times you get a rough and ready product and it works. And, you know, in between that, you get a lot of margin for errors where artists don't have a sense of their own selves such that they deliver something. And in their ears, it's raw and emotional. Yeah. And to your ears, it's just crap.
Yeah, totally. And that's the complete opposite. I mean, obviously, with the Infesticons, the whole nature of it, the aesthetic of the project is it's not going to ever be polished. Because the Majesticons was. That was the idea, that it was polished, kind of extreme moneyed pop.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and again, it wasn't, because it was Mike Ladd, but you could see what he was getting at with it. And I think he actually lost a few people on the way because they didn't quite understand where he was coming from. They were like, why are you trying to make R&B? And he was like, because I like R&B, but it's also part of the story.
Yeah. No, I like it. Good release. Yeah. Two thumbs up from me. Right, on Twitter, Catriona is saying, it was a lovely track. Haven't heard any of the new Infesticon stuff.
Well, you should hear it. It's totally gone under the radar. It's a shame, because the vinyl was strictly limited to about 500, I think. They're all numbered and they're very nice. And it's on one piece of vinyl, which I kind of miss.
What, just a single album?
Yeah, because, you know, when they started making double albums for people to play out, I think a lot of the time with those albums I didn't get to the second half for ages, because I used to play the first all the time.
Well, it's funny now you mention it, but it's slightly disruptive, isn't it?
Yeah,
because now you've got to turn two records over.
Yeah, well, not anymore, because no one buys any records, but...
All right.
That's not strictly true. But, I don't know, I'm releasing a record soon.
You are?
Yeah.
Is this the Demas one?
Yeah, the Wrong Tom Meets Demas album is it's almost in the can. I'm mixing it down for our first live show on Saturday. Plug, plug.
Where would that be, Tom?
To the Big Chewer House in King's Cross. We're on a 10, free to get in.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
No, it's good.
But we're shooting a video, actually. If I can plug further. We're shooting a bit of a makeshift video for the first single. So, yeah, if people do want to come along and jump around in the crowd and, act a fool in front of the camera, please be my guest, quite literally.
And how do they get in touch with you to do that?
By coming to the venue and being there.
Oh, what, on Saturday?
Yeah.
So you're shooting the video on Saturday?
On Saturday.
Sorry, you didn't say that.
Yeah.
Right, okay, I'm with you now.
Yep.
Oh, well, there you go then. An extra reason to go down.
Yeah.
Oh, very good. And what other albums you got coming out?
I've got, bloody hell, got the Palmer International Meets Wrong Tong album. I think that's going to be, God knows when that's coming out. It's all finished. It's over at the label. They're just doing the ins and outs, and hopefully the outs are weighed up in my favour.
Yeah, very good. We'll keep an eye on that as well then.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like having you on as a guest. Right, better knock that on the bloody head.
I get to do this again in about half an hour.
Yeah, Jesus. So I'm sort of changing tack with this. I was going to play something else, and I'm not now. I think it's a time of year thing, but I've gone back to playing a lot of Sufjan Stevens.
Okay.
Who I find to be a perennially quite annoying artist in that he sort of makes really, he's capable of making some of the greatest music I've heard in the last kind of 10 years minimum. You know, just cuts straight through all of the shit and delivers something where you're just like, you know, mouth hanging open, amazing. And then he tends to pad them with masses of really not particularly great music. Mm. So obviously he did the whole Illinois record, which is, to be fair, damn near perfect. It's a great record. But then ever since, he's sort of been on diminishing returns. He did an EP, which I only found the other day, and when I heard it, I was like, this is almost like he's trying to drive you away as a listener. It's like it sounded like a concerted effort just to irritate me. But when he shines, he is, you know, absolutely astonishingly brilliant. And I love that he's so singular. And I think it's easy to hate people like that. But for me, he's ace because he just goes away. He's got a kind of sonic palette that I think I've referred to many times when I talk about him, where he has got a touch of that sort of Brian Wilson thing of putting everything in the kitchen sink in the production, be it horns, percussions, weird electronic squelching noises. You know, everything goes in there so that you get a really rich kind of tapestry of sound. And it just... But it works, and it doesn't sound cluttered. It sounds quite beautiful, and I love it. And I just sort of, yeah, there's one song in particular that ends his last album called The Age of Odds, and it's 20 minutes long. Mercifully, the back end of it, the back 10, are not that great, but I thought I'd end with it tonight to see what people make of it. Because I think if you know who Sufjan Stevens is and you've heard his stuff, then you probably have made your decision, because I think he's kind of that kind of guy. You know, you'd hear it and be like, my bag or it isn't. I don't think you need five listens to work out if you like his music or not. For me, it took about 5 seconds. I was like, brilliant, this sounds like nothing else I'm hearing around at the minute. But this one is tacked right on the end of the album, and if you haven't heard it, I think it's frankly astonishing. And so I thought, you know, now and again you got to revisit artists we've played, because I think I've played Sufjan Stevens at least once before, potentially twice.
Yeah,
70 something shows.
Is it Sufjan that during an interview, somebody pointed out how his gear worked, and he found out that he's been going about it all wrong?
He's definitely a bit odd. I mean, he made his first album and he didn't know what to do about drums, so he made it while he was working at some ad agency, and he just installed Rebirth on his machine at work and made all the drums using Rebirth, which is, to those that don't know, a kind of software emulator of an 808 and a 909 and stuff. So his first album was just made with that, and he'd just literally make loops and take them home and put them in the songs. But then apparently when he made Illinois, which is a phenomenal record, he only had one SM58 mic. And then he's just like, yeah, I'll just use that. And there's an amazing interview with him in Tape Op magazine, and the bloke was like, are you serious? You used one mic? He's like, well, yeah, I couldn't afford any other gear, you know?
I think it was the Tape Op interview where he's looking at his gear and he sort of shows him a button that says, you know, you've got two extra tracks if you press that, or twice as many tracks.
It may well be.
He's like, bloody hell, I've
been yeah, I never
using
knew.
This wrong all this time.
Yeah.
This and is just open. Maybe this is it. Maybe now he knows how to use his gear better. He's not as good. You know, he's kind of, the limitation was what made him so great.
I love everything about him, and I consider him kind of one of the last true artists in that sense of, like, he did an appearance on, I think it was Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, and it was just a complete bloody, it was like a mindfuck. He was standing there dressed, what I can only describe as like a neon Native American. It was, and the entire band was decked out like it as well, in these kind of insane outfits. and all doing this bizarre formation dancing while playing. And it didn't look ridiculous. It just looked awesome. In the same way as when Funkadelic stepped out of the mothership with all that gear on, you didn't go, oh my God, what a bunch of knobheads. You were like, all right, go on, you know. We need this in the world. There's a lot of droll, dreary crap. We need people spicing it up.
I saw, talking of spicy, I saw Parliament with George Clinton, obviously, in a nappy on stage. That was his outfit, a nappy.
That'd be about right.
And there should be more nappies on stage.
But this is my thing. It's kind of like, I want the weirdos back.
Yeah.
It was all gone very dreary. And so I like the fact that Sufjan Stevens, a lot of people find it very easy to, you know, crit him. And just generally, I think, because he is quite an artist and he kind of had a big existential meltdown a couple of years ago where he basically just flipped out over music piracy and was just saying, I don't really understand. Why should I make music anymore? Because no one will buy it. No one cares enough to actually get it. They're just going to take it all for free on a format I don't even like. So why should I make an album? I don't get it. And he kind of just had this total meltdown and vanished and then came back with The Age of Ads as an album. And I think he's amazing. So, I thought I'd end with that and sound us out. So on that note, I suppose we should say our cheerios.
Until next week.
Yeah, and same time. In the meantime, I'll leave you with Sufjan Stevens, and this track's just glorious. It's called Impossible Soul.
Impossible soul. you.